Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Is it possible to sufficiently chronicle the throb and gristle of the New York food world as a vegetarian? Is that fair to the readers or to the restaurateurs? Will it consign one to the hippy-dippy freak show of niche restaurant criticism? Welcome to the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour Half Hour, and in this episode we'll be trying to answer at least some of those questions. In my last review for the New York Observer, I reviewed a restaurant called Samia in Brooklyn. It's a wonderful 8-seat tasting menu, spot by Jose Ramirez Ruiz and his wife or life partner, I guess, Pamela Young, who's also a chef in the kitchen. The thing that I love most about Samia is that it's veggie forward. It's not vegetarian, but at the same time, there's not that many meat dishes on the menu. In fact, no entree has a centerpiece that is meat. And it was a great opportunity for me as well to talk about my shift as a person and as a critic, because there's no real difference between those two, between eating meat and not eating meat. And it brought up a lot of questions of professional ethics and how they comport with personal morals. This is what I had to say. All I can say is that I want to be the change I believe in. If I don't think chefs are paying proper attention to the non-meating, meat-eating, or promoting dietary habits that are salutary to our physical or moral selves, as well as for the planet, and, you know, for all those miserable fucking cows, what better way to at least attempt to remedy that by appreciating when they do and sternly finger-wag when they don't? I've eaten at a tremendously high level since I became the critic for The Observer 2 years ago, and I hope I can continue to do so with this pivot. I don't see any inherent reason why one must choose between living and eating according to one's own morality and experiencing the best the city with an Olympic-sized pool of culinary talent has to offer. And that's why I love Samia, is that it obviates that choice. Today we have two guests, a musical and a non-musical, who in their own ways wrestle with this issue. The first is Ryan Patrick Sutton, the critic for Eater, and the second is Kyle Forrester, who's the closest thing to a house band that we have.
So I'd like to welcome to the program Ryan Patrick Sutton, the critic from Eater. Ryan, how you doing?
Good. How you doing, Joshua David Stein? Thank you for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
I'm so excited. The only other critic we've had on is Adam Platt, and that conversation went really well. And something I was talking to him about is I wish critics could talk to each other more. We weren't so siloed off in our little, you know, in our publications or whatever. And you've always been so open and, you know, friendly, just a good guy. So thanks for being on the program.
Well, thanks for being on it. And I completely second your suggestion. Now, one of the interesting things about, you know, restaurant criticism is that we often, I don't know, to a certain extent, we talk past each other. And part of that is good because we're in the business of criticizing and complimenting restaurants rather than criticizing other critics. And that brings us to the question of academia, where sometimes half of a position paper is discrediting the other guy with the longer beard at the other university. And even though it's interesting and it's good for infighting, a lot of what we do, I think, is the right thing in the sense that we don't debate with each other. We simply debate about the restaurants. But that said, it would be nice to get a bunch of us in a room every now and then and just say, listen, I think you're wrong about XX. I think you're right about XX. And here are some common themes that we agree on. And I think that would be good for the community. It's tough because a lot of us operate under the veil of anonymity. But if we could all get us on an NPR show or perhaps even on a Joshua David Stein Heritage Radio show, I think that would be a party.
Well, this is a start. I wanted to talk to you because I've kind of been lost in my own world a little bit. I wrote recently about Samia, this amazing restaurant in Brooklyn. I don't know if you've been there yet, but it's a 18-seat veggie-forward restaurant, which one I gave it 5 stars. I loved it. And one of the reasons I loved it, other than the quality of the food, is that I've been thinking for a long time now how uncomfortable I feel eating meat. Personally, you know, for ethical and sort of economic, just ethically, I don't feel good about doing it. And at the same time, for a long time, I felt that as a critic, it was my duty to really capture what chefs think about most and what will be of most use to the reader. And with this review that I wrote, I've kind of announced, so I can't go back on it, at least immediately, that I'm not going to really be reviewing meat dishes. I won't be going to vegetarian restaurants, but I won't be reviewing meat dishes. I haven't talked to any other critic about it, and I don't even know myself whether I'm betraying, you know, something or not. Am I not serving my readers for a personal thing? And I'm just curious, as a, you know, as a critic, I've read your work, obviously, from Bloomberg to now, and now at Eater, and I really admire your take, and I'm just curious what you think, and kind of how you see personal ethics and professional ethics interact.
Well, first of all, you know, listen, speaking for myself, I don't have a huge problem eating meat, and I wish I could articulate that in a beautiful way, but I simply, just as, and excuse the crude metaphor, just as some people close their eyes to poverty, and I like to think I'm not one of the people who closes my eyes to poverty, but just as some people close their eyes to certain issues, I perhaps need to, taking your lead and taking your, I think your very courageous lead, that you, and that position you took in that story, about, focusing more on veggie heavy restaurants at the expense of, other restaurants. And I, you know, and for example, like Bowery Meat Company, which you loved, I did not, but you loved that. And, you know, it seems that that's the type of restaurant that maybe you wouldn't, review in the future because of this, I think, again, very courageous stance you take. I don't want to say I'm so much closing my eyes to the problems of either in large-scale industrial meat production, which is a troubling phrase in itself, or the smaller-scale farmer production, in which even though that there's no, you know, large-scale slaughter of animals, even on the smaller scale where these animals are treated well, they are, in the end, involuntarily sacrificing their selves for our enjoyment. And from just a standard moral ethical standpoint, that's just... it's troubling when you think about it. And you know, one of the best ways around that, and I don't mean to be coy or flip, is simply not to think about it. And I think that, you know, all the more sheds more courageousness on the stance you're taking. But that said, I eat meat. And, you know, it reminds me of this, you know, listen, obviously meat eating is a much larger problem, and animal husbandry is a much larger problem at the industrial scale and at a lot of factory farms. But an anecdote I like to tell everyone, I think, reveals a bit about the American consumer. I go up to Blue Hill Stone Barns with my family every year. It costs $198 per person to tasting menu. It's absolutely delicious. It's one of those new vegetable-forward restaurants. It's been around for about 10 years, so actually I take that back. It's not a new vegetable-forward restaurant. About 60 to 80% of the meal is focused on vegetables. And my father, you know, who grew up in, you know, he was born in 1953, grew up in, you know, post-war abundance, even though he grew up with a family of modest means. And he's absolutely happy hearing all these wonderful lectures about how the pigs were well-raised and about how, you know, the asparagus was, like, petted and, you know, and fed deer or whatever. I'm just, you know, making this up. But, you know, you get all these beautiful tableside lectures about how the, you know, the vegetables are humanely raised and the animals are humanely raised.
Right.
And dinner for $1,000 after tax and tips. And then we go back home. And my father absolutely loves that, and so do I. But then we go back home, and he goes to Finest, or he goes to Pathmark, and he cooks Sunday dinner, and he looks for the absolute cheapest cut of meat possible. And
right,
that's what our Sunday dinner is. And so there's the dichotomy. To a certain extent, we have to applaud these restaurants that are vegetable-heavy and that raise only humanely, raise only humanely raised meat. But then the American consumer goes back to their home kitchen, and they find the cheapest cut of meat possible. And that, again, displays, I think, to me, you know, the dichotomy with restaurant food being fancy food and home food being cheap food. And I think that might be slightly analogous to what you're talking about, but I don't think it's a discrepancy that's worth overlooking. And how do we translate the fact that the American consumer, or at least certain American consumers like my father, and I like to think he's got to be representative of at least someone, who wants fancy food in restaurants where the animals are well-treated, and when he really, you know, couldn't care less about that at home, because the point of home cooking is to feed people in an economical way. And
right.
So I know that there are a lot of...
I think that's an interesting point, because that's another sort of binary between one set of ethics, like how can I feed my family in the most economical way and provide for my family in an economical way, in which case you use it, the cheapest product, versus, you know, trying to sort of enlarge that circle of empathy or whatever to include animals. And those are both are completely worthwhile codes of ethics. You know, it's like, they both have their merits. If I was a judge trying to decide that case, I think it's impossible to do, you know, especially from a standpoint of you and me, where we're reviewing really fancy restaurants. It's like, also, how does that speak to the regular person, you know, who can't afford that all the time?
It's an excellent question, but, again, continuing off that theme, I think it is, I think it's a very positive thing that fancy, and I think we saw a lot of this in the mid-aughts, especially in 2004, 2005, when Per Se opened up in New York. And even though I didn't give them the greatest review recently, I give them a lot of credit for putting the vegetable menu on par with the savory, non-vegetarian tasting menu. And
right.
What I mean by that is, like, a lot of fancy restaurants would offer a regular tasting menu, and then it would, at the bottom in small print, you know, vegetarian menu, you know, offered on request. What they do at Per Se, and what they've always done, and what I like to think they'll always continue to do, is the fact that they fully display what the vegetarian menu looks like. It's a separate offering. It's not a substitute offering. And not just that, not only is it advertised with the same weight as the regular menu, but it's offered at the same price.
Right.
And I think that's right on many different levels. It's right because it encourages people to choose it as an equally delicious option. And it also is indicative of the fact that, and even though people might not believe it, it's just as fancy, it's just as delicious, and often to a certain extent, it can actually cost just as much sometimes to make these vegetables fancy as it costs to make some of this meat fancy. And a lot of that is a byproduct of restaurants like the French Laundry, the sister restaurant to Per Se, has its own garden, and those gardens are incredibly expensive to maintain. Same goes for Meadowood in California. Same goes for Faison in California. People are operating these bespoke farms, and they can cost well over $100,000 a year to operate. And the more the American consumer can understand why something like this is expensive and delicious, I like to think, or I like to hope, that some of this, at least from the vegetable perspective, can trickle down. You know, the fact that, you know, I mean, with David Chang in 2004, when he opened up Momofuku Little Bar, and pork belly, which used to be cheap, all of a sudden became desirable, and all of a sudden it became perspective. I give a lot of credit to these vegetable-heavy chefs, from, you know, the Tate Root ladies, who have a Michelin star in Brooklyn, to Pamela Young over at Samita, which you were talking about, you know, to even restaurants like Faison, which are fish-heavy, but serve a heck of a lot of vegetables, and Meadowood, which serves one of the best vegetable dishes I ever had. It was a kale chip with a kale puree with the flavors of chorizo, but there was no meat in there.
Yeah.
And essentially, that they're taking something that people used to believe is cheap, and they're making them expensive, and part of it is simply by raising the price. And I know that sounds kind of classist, but, you know, I think that's the start of a
conversation. Well, no, I think in fine dining...
not just delicious, but expensive.
Yeah, in fine dining, that's sort of a lot of what people go by is price. So in that way, you know, the thing is valued, it's a very free market, right? The thing is valued exactly at what people will pay for it. And
or it's a Veblen, you know, you can look at it from a Veblen Good perspective. You know, people tend to pay more for certain things when they cost more.
Right.
If that's the right description of a Veblen Good, you know, a Louis Vuitton bag wouldn't be as desirable if it cost, you know, $40. It's more desirable because it costs $1,000. And the chef's counter menu at this restaurant in Meadowood in California is $500 per person, service included. And I think that creates, to a certain extent, a type of desirability among that type of consumer. Now, that said, to be fair, I understand that they run average food costs. They're certainly not ripping people off. And I had that menu, you know what? That's being delicious. But that said, I think we definitely have to think of the use of the Veblen Good.
We're a podcast, man. You can curse
respectful.
If you want.
No. I try to be respectful of the people I represent. But I'll go with the effing.
So I guess like I have two follow up questions for you. One, I mean, do you think it's possible or fair in New York City, just you know, personally and professionally, to review restaurants without really considering meat? Especially if I am reviewing places like, this is something I'm struggling with right now. Like if I am reviewing places like Bowery Meat Company, for instance, which I'm just mentioning because I went there, I liked it, and you also went there, didn't like it as much as you mentioned. But, you know, they do have, like, a cauliflower steak, and there are, they do think about it a little. I mean, I'm not saying that chefs give vegetables as much thought as they do protein, and I think that's a function of what people are ordering. But, you know, do you think it, is that fair? Is it possible? What are your thoughts? Oh, those are my, that's everyone freaking out in the background, if you can hear.
Is it fair? It's a good question. I don't know. And like, when you think about political science, there's a dichotomy between the delegate and the trustee. And you think of some a member of the House of Representatives as a trustee. They're elected once every 2 years, and they generally, I believe, govern more by poll than by anything else because they're on this constant re-election cycle and they have to reflect the will of the people. Whereas a senator is more of a trustee. In the sense that they can make more of their own decisions and they can lead the public rather than following them because they're only elected, I believe, once every 6 years, right. If I have my election math down right. And so this is essentially what we're talking about. Do we have to be followers as critics? Do we have to review every single thing the restaurant offers? Or can we be more delegates and leaders and set our own path for what we do as critics?
Right.
You know, do we have to review every single item on the menu? Can we simply take the vegetable item and take it from there? Can you review Bowery Meat Company simply on the basis of its non-meat items? You know what? I think it's an exciting prospect. And just as in statistics, the main goal is not to arrive at the truth, but the main goal in statistics is often to explain to the reader the assumptions that you're making. And once you explain to the reader the assumptions you're making, I think, you know, anything is possible. And that's where things start to get exciting. It's not so much the truth, it's the exploration of these ideas. You know, I believe it was A.O. Scott, you know, from the New York Times at one point, who said, you know, and I could be misquoting him here, that said the main point of criticism is like the expression and the exchange of ideas. And
right.
To me, that's a much more important part of review than I like this and I don't like that, because for that, you can just go to a Yelp review, you know. You know,
right.
My boyfriend took me to Bowery Meat Company. He liked the filet mignon and they, you know, they didn't stick a candle in his cupcake for his birthday, so therefore I don't like it. Obviously, very base view of criticism, and I'm sure they will stick a candle in your cupcake at Bowery Meat Company. They're actually really cool people over there. but that said, you know, the more important part of review are the ideas expressed. But there's also, a second stream behind this all. Can you review a restaurant not just for what it is, but for what it's not? And that's where you can get into, you know, ethically, you know, I think troublesome territory. But I don't think you're doing that because, like you said, Bowery Meat serves cauliflower steaks, and so many restaurants are trying to, espouse the vegetable heavy movement. You know, or
yeah, I think for me, like that difference between a representative and a senator is also really interesting because I see that writ large as well with veggie forward restaurants. Like I remember Ducasse doing. I think right before Adore shut down, they did like a mostly vegetarian menu, right? And I feel like a lot of veggie-forward restaurants, although it's changing now, a lot of veggie-forward restaurants were those senators, you know, were trying to lead the charge. But because they're so based on, you know, people actually coming in and ordering it, it's really hard to be out ahead of the crowd, right, when you're trying to fill seats. And, you know, personally, actually, that's something that I feel nervous about as a critic, taking this stance, which is comports with what I feel, you know, personally, how I feel ethic, you know, what I feel strongly about. But at the same time, you know, there's an ethics to selling newspapers or having the reviews be picked up. It's like, and the New York Observer, which has been very supportive so far, like, they're also justified in saying, well, you know what, Joshua, you're just not serving the reader. You're not serving the paper. So it's kind of, you know, it's everyone's behaving ethically and morally, but within their own sphere of what counts. I guess I had another question before I let you go back to the lovely climb of Chicago. Have you ever had an experience as a critic in your tenure where you felt sort of like tension between personal ethics and professional responsibilities?
Oh gosh, that's a good question, and I don't know if I've given enough thought of that as I should. But let me try something. Say something. You know, shooting from the hip, and that's less about personal convictions.
Yeah.
But more about what you were just talking about a minute ago. When I was back at Bloomberg, I often, almost always, reviewed the steak on any restaurant menu. It was for, I think, a very simple reason, because a lot of our clients at Bloomberg like steak. And whenever you put steak in the headline, I like to think it, the story did better. And now that I'm just thinking of this right now, I wonder if I set the wrong precedent by doing so. I wonder if I set the wrong precedent by always trying to review the steak for two on any random restaurant in the West Village. Because in the past, the steak for two is something you only used to see at Peter Luger or at a steakhouse. And now steaks for two are something that you see at every other American brasserie. And while it's good that we're taking steak out of the steakhouse and bringing the American consumer high quality meat in a restaurant that where the rest of the food is good, because in a steakhouse often the steak is the only thing that's good and it's served at these dumpy sides. But there's a flip side to that point. I wonder if I'm setting the wrong precedent by always reviewing the steak, and by always reviewing the steak, I almost encourage more restaurants that are not steakhouses to stick on the menu and creating this vicious cycle of Americans therefore eating more meat, because I'm reviewing the steak and just put more steaks in the menu, and therefore more consumers eat steaks. Whereas, and even though I was criticizing 99% of those as being, you know, flavorless, I wonder if I was setting the bad precedent, and if the better way is to is simply, you know, ignore that side of the menu, like perhaps you might in the near future.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I have a definite answer to that, but I'm troubled by how much steak I have eaten as a critic, because it is simply not an efficient way of eating an animal or feeding oneself to any extent, or an efficient use of the land or the environment.
Well, Ryan, thank you for calling in. Thanks for chatting with me. I hope this is the first of many conversations we have on air. I find it really interesting and enlightening, and, you know, just kind of great to be able to hear what's going on with kind of like how you think about these issues, because we think about similar issues a lot. You can read Ryan's writing on eater.com. He has, what else should we talk about? What else are you doing? Eater takes up all your time, I imagine.
Eater, I'm full-time at Eater. That's what I do. And I sell the price hike and the bad deal, but Eater is what I do. That's my job. I'm a critic and reporter.
And you do it very well. Ryan, thanks so much, man. Have a good day.
Thank you. I'm honored. I'm a big fan of your writing, and I can't wait to talk to you again.
We'll be back after a short break with Kyle Forrester.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Hey, what's up? This is John Norris, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network.
Now it's time for a musical guest who's gonna sing a song or two.
I'd like to welcome to the show Kyle Forrester, who has been on the show many times before. Kyle is what you would call a working musician. He will play music anywhere and go anywhere as long as the money is right, or really even if the money is wrong. He just loves to play. We had a long conversation, but here's the part I found most interesting. It's Kyle talking about the dilemma of bottled water on tour.
I mean, it's true that, like, in the biz in general, like, it's true, like, bottled water is, like, such a scourge You know, because it's considered to be like a nice thing. You go to, when you go to like a meeting at like a record company, it's like there's going to be a guy who comes around and like hands everybody like a Poland Spring bottle of water. That's like a part of like the industry, and it's thought of as like a nice thing. Or if you play at a nice theater, that's what they're going to do. They're going to like bring everybody a little bottle of water, and they're going to be like, "Well, make sure you have waters for you on stage," and you're going to have like three little bottles of water next to you.
So what do you do?
Well, I haven't had bottles of water for years, and I have my little thing, and I don't touch the bottles of water. Now, hopefully again, like with all this stuff, it's like, you don't know if you're really it's like what you're saying about eating meat. Like, what's funny about that is like, okay, so you can make the decision not to eat meat, but it's like, if you are at somebody's house and they're like, "Hey, we have all this extra chicken," are you going to say, "No, I don't eat that," or are you going to eat the chicken? And then, or what if you don't eat it and then they're just going to throw it out or whatever that is? So it's that kind of, those kind of things come up. But, and then as far as like what you would let yourself, you know, what you would let yourself be, you know, associated with or, you know, let your music be used for with something. It's tricky also though, because it's like, you're not often in the position of like, if you're doing, I don't know what's even an example. What's it like? Halliburton isn't going to ask to use my music. You know, Bruce Springsteen stood up to Reagan when he was using porn. I think Bruce Springsteen has multiple times had to tell Republicans not to use his music. Yeah. Which is funny.
Kyle, I want to thank you for being a guest on the Joshua David Stein program.
Thanks.
Could you give us some music to go out on?
All right, sure.
This has been the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour, half hour. I'd like to thank all of our guests tonight, Ryan Patrick Sutton and Kyle Forrester, and of course our lovely engineer, Liz Smith. Tune in next week. Have a good night.
Money changes everything.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.